യോന്തപ്രവിശ്യ മമ വാചമിമാം പ്രസുപ്താം സഞ്ജീവയതി അഖിലശക്തിധരസ്വധാമ്ന അന്യാംശ്ച ഹസ്തചരണശ്രവണത്വഗാദീൻ പ്രാണാൻ നമോ ഭഗവതേ പുരുഷായ തുഭ്യം. ഗുഡ് മോർണിംഗ്. ടുഡേസ് ടോപ്പിക് ഈസ് ലിവിംഗ് വേദാന്ത എൻഷ്യൻ്റ് ഫിലോസഫി മീൻസ് മോഡേൺ ലൈഫ്. Perhaps, you know, this is a very, very relevant topic for modern times. What do we understand by modern life, modernity, or modernism, whatever we may call it? It implies many things. On the one hand, modern life, modern age has many blessings, many great fruits of explosive developments in science and technology, communication, transport, and many things. So today, the whole world, humanity has become a single family. Even the ancient dictum from the Mahabharata, so udara charidanam tu vasudhaiva kutumbakam. The literal meaning is vasudha means the earth. By implication, humanity. Kudumbaga means family. So humanity of world is one family, but it's an ancient concept found in the Mahabharata, which is in a way a restatement of the teachings of the Vedas. But that has become a reality in a truly physical sense in modern times. At the physical world has become one. But then, when we become one, we can also be torn apart. So when we become close to each other physically, we can be remote from each other in all other respects. So that's what has happened today. You don't have to go too far. If you go to any airport, railway stations, or any place, you can find people looking at the tools of modern technology. It could be iPhone, it could be computer, whatever it is, and communicating with some people living in distant places, but totally ignorant, totally ignoring maybe the close relations who are sitting along with them. So you can say physically close to each other, but psychologically or maybe spiritually torn apart, living apart from each other. So distance is a concept that we have in our mind. We can be very distant physically, but one together. And we can be very close to each other physically, but still far away from each other. So this is a special problem of modern age. So as I mentioned, science and technology can be a very wonderful tool in our hands, a very useful instrument that can make our life better in all respects. Great ideas can be transmitted and shared and discussed with the help of these new explosive developments in science and technology. But terrible toxic material also can be transmitted, can be globally distributed. So it is like a knife that could be in the hands of an assassin and that could be in the hands of a surgeon. A surgeon uses it for saving life. The murderer uses the same instrument for taking life. This is one aspect. Another aspect is, in modern times, utilitarianism has become the norm. Utilitarianism, a kind of ultra-pragmatism, as an history, you know, going back to James Bentham, J.S. Mill, and others. But in the early days, they were very primitive compared to modern utilitarian standards. The usefulness of anything should be judged in terms of the maximum amount of pleasure it brings to the maximum number of people. It's a very, very utilitarian, very pragmatic interpretation. But when you judge everything on the basis of utility, you're always thinking about practical utility. So what happens is, everything becomes an instrument for improving material life. You know, in ancient India, again, when I'm talking about this, the subject is, you know, ancient philosophy meets modern life. So I can just give a glimpse to, let's say, a dialogue taking place in ancient India. Those who listen to, unfortunately, lectures in her temples, frequently they don't get an opportunity to connect these things. They mostly are fed with the stories, mythologies, you know, Ravana having 10 heads or some demons living for thousands of years, all those stories you find. But the same literature, these stories are not meant to be taken seriously. A story is meant to tell a story behind. There's a message behind. So this dialogue is between a great philosopher king and a group of sages. I think this is the first reference or first discussion between a philosopher king long before Marcus Aurelius or Plato wrote the Republic, in which he conceived this idea of an administrator who is a philosopher and also a king, the philosopher king idea, which in ancient India is called Rajarshi. It goes back to Mahabharata and Bhagavad Gita, it's a part of Mahabharata. So such a philosopher king, his name is Nimi, and he's sitting in his court. So I want to bring you to something which is so relevant in this 21st century, when you are working in the world of artificial intelligence or information technology. So the king and the 10 sages. So the way the name of the sage is, there are many, but one of them is Antariksha. So Kavir Khavir Antariksha Prabuddha Pippalayanaha Avir Hotrotha Dumilas Chamasa Karabhajanaha. 10 sages are coming to visit the philosopher king. Kavi Hari Andariksha Prabuddha Pippalayana Samasa Tamasa Pippalayana and Karabhajanaha. Don't worry about the Sanskrit statement. But if I don't quote Sanskrit, you may think I'm taking stories from some modern things which people do in modern times, you know. So I don't want to do that. Not only that, if I don't connect you to the ancient roots, there is no justification. In our tradition, you know, there is padavakya pramana abhyam pravo. It means you have to refer, when you talk about some ancient tradition, you have to, as far as possible, especially for those who are monk in the Hindu monastic order, or if you are a priest in Jesuit tradition, you have to quote from Aquinas and Augustine. If you're an evangelical, you can say whatever you want, that's a different thing. YouTube, the Lord, YouTube is there to teach you everything. But in modern times, you have to connect with the original roots. So the verse is Kavi Hari Antariksha Prabuddha Pippalayana Avishrotra Dumisa Chamasa Kalabhajana. 10 of them. And now, this king asks a question, puts a question to these 10 sages. And one of the great answers given by a sage, Antariksha, is, you are a spiritual person, you are a wise man. When you can see the divine in everyone, and when you see everyone in the divine, let's say, you may can call it God in whatever tradition, you can, that's wonderful. But your idea of this transcendental divinity should be an all-accommodating, compassionate, all-knowing divine principle, and not somebody sitting somewhere who asks you to obey, and if you don't obey, then you are destined to go to hell. Not that kind of a divinity. So that's why He says, in the spiritual humanism, you can be a true human being when you see in everyone the divine, the principle, the presence of the divine, and when you see the divine in everyone. So this is the highest spiritual wisdom. So this is the wisdom of Rishi. Rishi means a sage. Rishi is typically a wise man in ancient times. Rishi is somebody who can see far into future and also who can see everything together. Let's say a wise person. If you go to a wise person, he won't give an answer immediately, something that will just interest you, something that will please you. He will give an answer that you need, and not necessarily an answer that will please you. So that's a sign of a Rishi. A Rishi is one who takes care of the needs of the world and not trying to please anyone in this world. Such a Rishi. And the Raja. Raja is a king. You need not take in his purely, literal sense, in a king. No. Somebody who is a man of action. That is Raja, the meaning of Raja, the king. Rajyattum Aishwarya Sambhati Rishittum Tasyaha Sukshmartha Dasana Kshamattu. What it means is, being a king implies you should be a successful person. You be a big CEO of a company, very successful, very ambitious, very active, very efficient. And let's say, go-getter, or maybe a man of success, who considers success as a beginning and end of human existence. Such a man is king, let's say, executive, a man of worldly success. That is Rajatva. Aishwarya Sambhati means prosperity, all the needs of the world completely fulfilled. A big CEO, a lot of money. That is the implication of calling a person a king in this traditional sense. Philosopher is somebody, Rishi, who is he? Tasyaha Sukshmartha Dasana Kshamattu. A wise man who can understand where success stops. Beyond a limit, worldly success cannot take you beyond a limit. So worldly success cannot really help you to succeed in life. It can help you to succeed in getting a job, can help you to succeed in accumulating lots of money, but cannot necessarily help you to succeed in life, because success in life is different from success in job, business, industry, or anything. A man who is very successful in business and industry can be a total disaster, absolute failure in life. Life could be put in capital letter. So, a Rishi or a philosopher is somebody who can see so far into future and see the limitation of success, the limitation of the fruits of science and technology, or the blessings of science and technology. He's called a philosopher king. So in the fourth chapter of Gita, there is a very interesting discussion. Imam vivasade yogam proktavanaham avyam vivasvan manave praha manu ikshakave abravit evam parampara praptam imam rajasyo viduhu sakaleneha mahada yugo nashta parantava. First and second verses of the fourth chapter of the Gita. Here, the teacher Lord Krishna is describing a lineage of philosopher kings who taught the world how to succeed in material life, but also how to succeed in real life, in emotional life, in life which includes your interaction with other members of society and family, where you can enjoy success as a contentment within, but also you can enjoy harmonious relationship with others. So here he says, this is a lineage, great philosopher kings who taught this wisdom. And the name of this wisdom, this particular term used to describe this wisdom, is Karma Yoga or Sodharma or Yoga, simply speaking, or Vedanta in its practical sense. So Vedanta in action is called Yoga. So Yoga Nashta Parantava. So here Lord Krishna says, in the ancient times, there was the lineage of great teachers who were not living in forests with a long beard, meditating. No. In fact, they were active people. They were active executives. They were kings, not just figureheads. In modern democracy, there are kings who are just ceremonial figureheads, but they were reigning monarchs in medieval times. So they were practicing a way of life which was modern in a very real sense of the term, but also ancient, because they used an ancient wisdom to live this modern life. That is a combination of action and contemplation, a harmony of action and contemplation. Action is necessary. Action in a way implies modernism or modernity, because in this modern age we have to be active, but you need not necessarily be utilitarian in the superficial sense of the term. You need not just judge life in terms of practical utility or practical usefulness, because when we judge everything by practical utility, there's a big problem. We may reduce ourselves into the levels of animal kingdom. You see, animals, they are guided by the instinct, and the instinct works at the practical level. So you can see that's how animal kingdom functions. But human beings have an additional luxury of thinking about ultimate meaning of life and existence. So going beyond utility, going beyond utilitarian values. The utility is necessary. We cannot ignore or we cannot forget the importance of utility and practicality. But if we become too practical, and then we may end up being morons or machines. That's a problem. Machines don't have ideals that guide them. So human beings also can be reduced to the level of machines, judging everything on the basis of practical utility. That's one problem of modern age. So this modern age needs all the blessings of science and technology, but also the blessings of ancient wisdom. And in this Gita, Lord Krishna talks about these ancient wise men called rishis. What they were doing? Of course, they were, by themselves, they were teaching great philosophy, but they were also guiding great kings. So how to practice Sodharma or Dharma? Now, Dharma implies something very abstract and also very, very simple. Dharma literally means that we suppose, preserve, sustains, protects. That's what the meaning of Dharma, through root. Now, how does Dharma protect you? When you are guided by this higher ideal, we are guided by one important principle. Life in this world is not the only life we have got. In Far Eastern, in Indian tradition, mostly in the religions of Indian origin, Buddhism, Hinduism, Sikhism, Jainism, you know, these religious traditions, they teach two fundamental tenets which may not be acceptable in modern times, maybe according to Abrahamic theologies, but many of them do accept. And if we can rely upon Gibbon, who wrote the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, they say in the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD, the Council of Nicaea, which is the division of the Christian, Eastern and Western Christianity, Christian traditions, this was put to vote whether we should believe in the concept of doctrine of karma and reincarnation. So he just put to vote and he voted out, so that from Constantine, who was the one who established Christianity as a religion of the Western world up to the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD. So these two tenets were taken out. So according to many of the teachings of the early Desert Fathers and early Christians, the doctrine of Bhav Karma, reincarnation, are accepted principles. I don't want to go to that sufficiently. If you can ask questions during the interaction that we will have after this lecture. The point is, in Vedantic tradition, they believe that this life is not just one chance. Death is not a full stop. Death is only a semicolon or a comma. You are born again. Second principle is, whatever we do in this world will have its effect in our destiny. And what we are today has something to do with what we did in our previous life. So this doctrine of law of karma and doctrine of reincarnation. So these two important principles are very significant in Vedantic tradition. If you can keep in mind, then we won't be tempted by these ultra utilitarian ideologies. That's a very important thing. We may think something is practical, but then that may have a consequence. Maybe not in this life, in the next life, or maybe in this life itself, because our karma or action, whatever we do, we have some influence on what we are going to be in future, what we are going to go through in future. So this is one important principle in Vedanta. This is law of karma, and it is intimately connected to the doctrine of reincarnation. And second principle in Vedanta is, that is the highest ideal of ancient wisdom from Vedantic standpoint. It is, it tells you that this world is wonderful, it's perfectly okay, but there is a higher reality that we may not be able to understand in this world. Brahma Satyam Jagat Mithya. This is one central doctrine of Vedanta. That's what I'm coming to. So we should live in this world. We should have all the good things in this world and make use of all the tools of modernism, modern science and technology. Can accumulate money, no problem. Can succeed as much as we want, no problem. We can have all the good things of this world, absolutely no problem. But remember, there is something higher than that. So there is a higher dimension to what we are. We are not just physical human beings. If we can look upon ourselves only as physical human beings, there is no scope for any peace of mind. Because you look at any human body, no human body can be perfect. The slightest experience of pain and grief at a physical level will be a huge disaster in our life if we define ourselves as physical beings. Just imagine, if you eat organic food and go to the gymnasium every day, and go, it's not a very big thing, easy thing, but you have a very good medical system, you may aspire to live for 100 years. That should be a great success. Not beyond that. So this physical body and all the wealth that we accumulate, all the success that we may obtain in this world with our efforts, with our efficiency, with our enthusiastic work and dedication, all that we may accumulate, but these things will one day disappear. So far as you are concerned, you cannot take your checkbook and fountain pen when your body is pushed through the tube. That is in essence. The money in the bank, the checkbook and the fountain pen with which you sign your checks. You'll be left behind when you're 100 years old, when the body is pushed through a tube. Even a crematorium manager who does this every day, maybe many times every day, he also doesn't remember. He also thinks that he is going to live eternally. That's something very interesting. And you know, surprisingly, there is a funny episode in the Mahabharata. There's an interesting, again, some kind of a discussion. One celestial being puts a question to Yudhishthira. What's the most astonishing, most mysterious truth about human existence? And the answer given is, Yudhishthira, a wise man of Mahabharata, says, every day, every minute, every second, many people, many living beings, insects, bacteria, in all of them die and disappear. Every day. There is not one day in which one human being somewhere in this world doesn't die. Maybe there is not 1 hour, so to speak. So this happens every time. And I don't think there is a simple split second where you don't see some insects disappearing and being killed. But still, we think we are going to live for all time. This is the greatest mystery. In fact, according to modern psychologists, it is this belief that keeps us going. It is something absolutely wrong. It is a terrible lie if you are told that we are going to live for all times. But the point is, and we know as a matter of fact, but somehow we don't keep that in mind. So Vedanta tells you, just keep in mind all the money, all the things are very good. You should work hard, succeed in life. But this success will one day disappear. Now, what is the beneficial result of this wisdom? It gives us a spiritual level-headedness. So when we push ourselves too far, too much, by greed, by competition, by jealousy, by desire for worldly things, for enjoying things, when we are driven by our own ambitions beyond the limit, driven by our own desires beyond the limit, then we can tell ourselves, well, I should work hard, I must succeed, I must make money, everything is wonderful. But still, I should not forget the fact that one day these things will be left behind. It need not make us skeptical or pessimistic, not at all. It will just help us to look at the world and our own life from a more mature standpoint. We become really mature in looking at our own life. That is the essence of the fundamental principle of this ancient wisdom, Brahma Satyam Jagat Mithya. There is something beyond the physical body, beyond mind, beyond enjoyments. That's my true essence. That is Vedanta, you may call it Atma, Brahman, whatever you may call it. Or maybe in Christian tradition, we call it the Christian experience, it's called. In Augustine's City of God, as you ascend further and further, the kingdom of God. That is some kind of a permanent, compared to what we have in this world, some kind of celestial experience. This is what Vedanta tells you, the essence of our life. So if you can keep this in mind, that all the enjoyments of this world are necessary, there is absolutely no problem, nothing wrong in aspiring for them, but even while working hard for them, keep in mind that they are not going to last long. The fact that they are not going to last long doesn't depend upon our understanding. Even if we think they are going to last long, they are not going to. The point is, we often forget this. And that is one aspect of ancient wisdom. In the Gita, Bhagavad Gita, that you frequently read, you can find Lord Krishna teaching Arjuna this practical method. Now, I'm not going to details of this, because we have more than 200 classes in our YouTube videos on Bhagavad Gita. So there's no point in bringing those things again. But one point, in that story, in that message, the background, Arjuna is a man of action. And Krishna is a wise man, the teacher. Now, when Arjuna was facing a problem, when you were supposed to do a very unpleasant duty, a very unpleasant responsibility had to handle, he became depressed, he became confused, he became terribly disturbed. Then Krishna tells him how to confront the reality of an unpleasant duty. A duty, a work that you don't want to do, but that is your duty to do. If you avoid a duty, then the duty will follow you, and you have to do it in a very unpleasant manner. So better do your work as a master and not as a slave. So the first instruction that Krishna gives to Arjuna is not high philosophy, simple thing. Instead of keeping quiet, sitting in a corner without doing anything, thinking that by doing nothing you can avoid the problems of action. Every action has its problem. There is no activity, there is no action without some problem. But if you think that you can avoid the problems by avoiding action, then what is going to happen is problems will be there without action. Problems will chase you, will follow you to the ends of the earth. So there is no question of avoiding a duty, even if that duty is unpleasant. That's so. The first stage is one should do one's own duty with a sense of sanctity and sacredness. Because by not doing our duty, we are inviting more trouble than the troubles we may have to face when doing our work. So better do our duty with a sense of sanctity and sacredness. It's called sodharma. Whatever may be your position in society, a doctor, your duty as a doctor, engineer, whatever may be. Sodharma, one's own sacred duty. A duty that could be understood and defined in terms of your status in society, your own fitness and what society expects from you. That you should do with a sense of sanctity and sacredness. Here you're bringing an element of sacredness and sanctity into your everyday work, and that will spiritualize everyday duty. Then second stage is, if you're very ambitious and do all your work all the time, still, as I mentioned earlier, the most successful person in this world may not be the happiest. That's because he has succeeded in his business, in his job, in his profession, but he has terribly failed in his life. So life and success are two different things. You may have succeeded in your profession, in your life, a businessman, engineer, doctor. You are a great success. But deep within you, you have not succeeded. Because your mind is not able to enjoy the fruits of your own success. That means life is a failure. So Krishna brings in the idea of karma yoga. The first lesson is, do your duty. The second lesson is, after becoming efficient, after succeeding in life, still the mind is troubling. Mind is not happy. That means you have succeeded in your profession and your material responsibilities, but terribly failed in life. The life you should be capitalized. Then what you should do, you should bring in a spiritual element into the performance of duty. That is, yoga should be brought in. And yoga and karma together becomes karma yoga. So that's what is called a harmony of action and contemplation. What's the role of contemplation here? The contemplation is simple. You are working hard, you are succeeding in life, but same time, you should be able to tell yourself, this success is not enough. So there is something higher that you can aspire for. And that is called spiritual enlightenment. Meditation, prayer, all this. They can fill the vacuum that's left behind. Even when you succeed the highest level in life as a whole. Then Lord Krishna says, a third level, when you get established in this, called karma nishtha, means, that's the philosopher king we mentioned earlier, with the Plato's philosopher king, Marcus Aurelius or Nimi, Janaga, all the great names you find in ancient traditions, either in the Greco-Roman heritage and also India's Vedic tradition, Vedic heritage. The Rajarshi or the philosopher kings. What they do? They're efficient to the utmost level. They are successful. They are able to do their work perfectly. But at the same time, they can enjoy their life because they are not attached to their success. They are not slaves of their own success. They are not prisoners of their own success. So it is something very important. Very often, when we succeed, we become prisoners of our own success. And this lack of freedom, this slavery, happens when we get attached. So these philosopher kings, they did everything, but they were not attached. In the Gita itself, there is one important verse, which outlines this. This strange combination of success of a very successful executive and the wisdom of a very contemplative sage. Saktaha karmani avidvamso yatha kurvanti bharata kuryan vidvan tatha asaktaha chigishu loka sangraha. Tells you, let's say a story of two brothers or two friends, so to speak. One man, he works very hard and he is very successful. But, and he smiles, a big diplomat, you know, they're trained how to smile even when they have terrible problems in their mind. So, everything wonderful, but deep within, he is absolutely broken. And it is a strange problem of this modernism or modern age. You have to have different layers on the face. Say, how are you? You know, all that. In a way, all this is very good. I'm not condemning them. But point is, so many layers, artificial layers, we are covering ourselves with. So that we don't know what is our personality. In information technology, artificial intelligence, you know, there are so many alternate worlds that are created, so many alternate use. Your name is George, so many alternate Georges. You know. Every individual creates so many different artificial copies of his own personality and so many artificial worlds in which he inhabits. So many artificial layers, one up to the other. So that creates lots of problems. That's because of attachment. Saktaha karmanya vidvamsu. So those who don't know this Vedanta wisdom, they get attached, they become prisoners of their own success, they become prisoners of their own prosperity. Because when they work hard to succeed, to become prosperous, they forget something totally different. You know, during the COVID times, I had the fortune or maybe misfortune of interacting with many members of the old age homes in Bay Area and different places. So frequently, grandmothers, grandparents used to mention, nowadays their children don't care for them. As soon as they reach 60 years or even below that, they are dumped in some old age homes. So talking about, let's say, the joint family traditions of the East, how wonderful. And I often tell them, see, when you are bringing up the children, you are forcing them, compelling them, you are encouraging them to get high grades, good education, and high paying jobs. But you didn't teach them anything about life as a whole. So when life is defined in terms of material success, what happened, you know, later on, those children don't know what to do with their own success. So this happens. So in this story which I mentioned, the verse Saktaha Karmanya Vidyamso Yadha Kurvanti Bharata, the first person Saktaha is very efficient, working very hard, very successful, but he is a slave, he is a prisoner of his own success. So he cannot enjoy life. He has a lot of money, but he cannot enjoy the fruits of his own achievement, his own success, because of his attachment. Every day, every minute, he defines life. He understands life only in terms of material success. That is attached. You are chained by an invisible chain, by your own attachment. Then the other person, the Kuryan Vidwan Tatha Asaktaha Chigishulakrasangra. His brother is also working equally hard, equally successful, equally efficient, but he is enjoying life because he is non-attached. So what is non-attachment? Non-attachment doesn't mean that you should not have affection or love, compassion for others, not at all. Non-attachment in Vedanta means you care for everyone, but you are not obsessed by the results of your actions. You are very much active, you are efficient, you accomplish great things, but those accomplishments do not act as a prison house for you. So in that respect, you say you detach yourself while accomplishing great things. How do we detach? The way to do is, well, understand, these accomplishments, this success, all these will one day disappear. This is simple common sense, everyone knows. Even a child studying in kindergarten knows that he is not going to live beyond 100 years. He doesn't see his own grandparents living around. They passed away years ago. So he knows. But the point is that knowledge, the knowledge that all material things are essentially impermanent, which also the spiritual wisdom of Buddhism is part of Vedic tradition. But this we know, intellectually we know, but very often what we know intellectually doesn't become emotional wisdom. That's the point. So Vedanta helps you to transform, to translate what we know as a fact into our own simple common sense that we can use in our everyday life. In this respect, you find Vedanta becomes a kind of universal spiritual humanism. It is not an abstract philosophy. Frequently, people quoting the Sanskrit verses written thousands of years ago, they think some kind of abstract, world-negating, life-negating, absolutely unpractical kind of utopian philosophy. That's frequently how Vedanta is misunderstood and misrepresented, unfortunately, in modern times, mostly because of translations which cannot do full justice to the actual sense in which the Sanskrit words are used, actually. So what Vedanta means is simple. You can have all the good things of this world, all that modern science and technology provide you with, all the gifts and blessings of science and technology, but you should use them as a surgeon uses his knife, not as a murderer uses his knife. It could be used for good and bad. So Vedanta offers this unique spiritual common sense. Again, it is not limited to Hindu tradition. That's another terrible misunderstanding. People often associate this Vedantic ideal with some rituals going on in temples. Rituals are meant to keep society somehow linked to this ancient heritage. And many of them who perform these rituals may not be aware at all of the essential tenets of Vedanta. That's a fact. But the point is, the essence of Vedantic wisdom is simple. Everything in this world is impermanent. Again, this is not a new wisdom that comes from Vedanta. It is something everyone knows. As I mentioned, you know, even a crematorium manager who is always trying to welcome as many dead bodies as possible so he can make more money. He pushes the body every day to the tube. He also thinks that he's going to live for all time. That's why his greed increases day by day. So what we know very often doesn't translate into wisdom, into common sense that we can actually use in our everyday life. So Vedanta just helps you to transform what we already know, the simple common truth that everyone is aware of intellectually, but not able to use emotionally. So I was trying to give a very short, brief introduction to this, to some of these practical aspects of this ancient spiritual philosophy. So very often we miss that practical aspect because we often either we become too comical, too simplistic and too modern to such an extent that we lose sight of the ancient wisdom. It's something like, you know, if you go on adding more and more water, there is no milk left, only water is there. That's one danger. Or you may get condensed milk that can create diarrhea. So what is needed is these ancient roots should be refuted. That's one of the reasons why I often refer to and quote and recite the ancient verses. Just to demonstrate that these ideas are not new ideas. They are coming from the ancient heritage. At the same time, these ancient teachings are not abstract philosophical doctrines written and discussed thousands of years ago. They do have a practical value in modern times. Maybe they are more valuable, more relevant in our times than perhaps they were thousands of years ago when they were first recorded and taught in this world. So thank you. Namaste. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.